Live from New York City, it's the Gary Null Show. And now, your host, Gary Null.
Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Null. A study from Harvard University talks about fiber can lower breast cancer risk. This was published in the Peer-Reviewed Journal of Cancer. And think of all the lives that could be saved if we just paid attention to this one single piece of the puzzle to health. But we have a lot more following that today, all from peer-reviewed literature, all from respected institutions, just not discussed in the mainstream media. Also today, I'm going to ask you for feedback, your time to talk back. I'll give you those numbers in just a moment that you can call in and share your points of view. But before we get there, we're going to learn about how one particular therapy was able to reverse sepsis, which has a very high death rate. And there's millions of people who end up with sepsis. I've dealt with sepsis in people I've counseled, a lot of them at the Tri-State Healing Center. But 2 years before we opened the center to the public, I was already using myself as a guinea pig, taking very high dose vitamin C. What would it do to someone who's never smoked or drank or had drugs or been sick, a vegan, taking lots of supplements, exercising, doing marathons? What would it do to my body? And after I had about 30 different blood chemistries over a two-year period, I did an analysis. And then it was simply a hypothesis that would be proven correct, that it enhances even further a healthy person's immune system. But in a sick person, it helps the immune system get up to where the body can defend itself. But I'm not saying any of this today. Instead, we have a medical doctor, board-certified physician, Dr. Paul Marik, M-A-R-I-K, who starts off with a whole group of medical doctors saying that he probably will not be accepted and that what Simon Weiss went through, he is going through, I'm not going to give you the reveal on this. Let him. He does a really good job. But there's three things to learn from this video that you'll watch or listen to. One, that today's medicine is still practicing with limitations. Not limitations in technology. We're extremely advanced there. But limitations in the ability to surrender one belief system and one group of knowledge in order to embrace something that replaces that is even better. Two, that there are non-toxic and natural therapies that can work with, in conjunction, or by themselves in dealing with life-threatening conditions. And I believe that's also true when it comes to not just the current virus, the coronavirus 19, but all viruses and pathogenic bacteria. The stronger your immune system, the greater capacity for you to resist, or the shorter, let's say, duration with less severity and the quicker recovery. But we are doing nothing except the basics, which are still good, and I fully support them, washing hands. But we should be having a national program to get people's immune systems in a very different place. Also, I'm writing an article today, along with Richard Gale, and we're using all the science that we can find in the world. We've been on this for over a week. And I can simply say that the people giving us information on what we must know as if it were a fact are unfortunately incorrect. The math doesn't add up. And I believe that is serious and deadly and as susceptible to even young people are of this virus. So we must take this seriously. There is a fine line between informing a public, having to protect the public, and then panicking the public. When you step over that line from, yes, it's serious, yes, it's deadly, yes, everybody could get sick from it, yes, people are dying from it, that's legitimate. but to then take it to where you can then input laws, including mandatory vaccines for, you can bet that's coming on this. And everything else that you're doing late. So we took a look at the countries that are having a decline in coronavirus infection and death. And I will go through the article. What did these five countries do that is helping their citizens where we're not doing the same? So that'll be tomorrow in a special original investigative report, because we look at the numbers. And quite frankly, the numbers do not add up. They just don't. And I defy any mathematician or medical biostatistician or public health biostatistician or epidemiologist. You look at our numbers and you compare them to the official numbers of Anthony Fauci and other people. I'm not ascribing motive. Good people can make mistakes. But there are a huge number of mistakes that we're making when it comes to what this virus is, what it can do, and how we should go forward. Anyhow, that's tomorrow. But today we're going to show you how one nutrient has reversed people otherwise would die, and a little background on that. That's a good one. Also today, why are so many young people committing suicide? More than we've ever seen in American history in a single generation. 300% higher than any other generation in American history. Why? Now, this is not a simple issue, and there are many multiple factors that contribute to this. But there's a millennial giving us an answer. And what I can agree or disagree with, at least he's presenting stuff that is not in the normal dialogue and certainly not among millennials. So we're going to take a look at that as well. And then, do you ever ask yourself, how does so much corruption get sanitized in the American body politic and in the workplace? Well, there's an interesting lecture before a TED group by a woman who is exposing corruption, but not just to the people that are making the immediate profit off it, all the enablers behind the scenes. It's a fascinating look at who benefits and therefore who enables crimes of all types. And I could apply this to the military-industrial complex, to the banking society, to big agriculture, virtually every institution, including religious institutions in the United States. Who are the people behind the scenes who are never accused, never have to say they're sorry, never have to pay restitution, get to keep the ill-gotten gains, and therefore never change? And it's getting worse. We're going to have that one as well. So that's what we got coming at you today. Oh, and right after health and nutrition, and before we go to a break, I ask a couple of the people here yesterday, I said, who would like to come on the air and just give the audience at home, as well as those who are doing this anti-aging study from their home, an update on your own specific journey? I don't want to know about it. I'll hear what you have to say when the audience hears what you have to say. So you're going to have a chance to hear one of the individuals and what they've learned over the last 3 weeks. All right? This is from Harvard University, and they're stating very specifically that when you consume a diet high in fiber, you're reducing the incidence of breast cancer. And this was a very detailed analysis of all the relevant prospective studies. And because studies have generated inconsistent results regarding the potential relationship between fiber intake and breast cancer, a Dr. Farid at Harvard's University's Chad School of Public Health and her colleagues researched all relevant prospective studies published through July 2019. And when the investigators pulled all the data from 20 observational studies, they identified individuals with the highest consumption of fiber had a statistically significant reduction in the risk of breast cancer. And soluble fibers were the ones that created the lowest risk of breast cancer. So, do we need to know about eating blueberries? And all berries, for that matter, because they create a soft, soluble fiber of flaxseed, hemp seed, sesame seeds also are terrific. Walnuts, all your nuts, almonds, pistachios, those are good. And then green vegetables, also good. The more you have, the less your risk of breast cancer. Also from Zhen Jintong University's Health Science Center in China and Harvard School of Public Health, they did the study together. The researchers are stating that eating tofu and other soy-based foods can improve your heart health. And this was published in the peer-reviewed journal Circulation. So this is new research. I have over 5,500 studies from the peer-reviewed literature showing that soy, and we're talking about non-genetically engineered soy, can help all forms of health conditions. Well, this is a new study, and it shows that soy-based foods can reduce the risk of coronary heart disease. And why? Same reason as these other 5,000 studies. ISO flavones, F-L-A-V-O-N-E-S. Now, that's a type of compound that occurs naturally in some plant-based foods. And if you ate tempeh, you would get it. Tofu, you would get it. And because they're rich in these isoflavones. Now, that's the takeaway message. It's that simple. We're not saying you have a lot of it. We're saying you have it as a part of an overall varied diet. Okay, and they tested 168,000 women and 42,000 men. That's 200,000 people were tracked for 20 years. And all were free of heart disease and cancer at the beginning of the study. And then they saw those who stuck with the diet had a substantially lower risk of heart disease. So, good news for tofu. This is from King Abzuzis University in Saudi Arabia. It says that when you're taking your standardized curcuminoids, that's your curcumin, and it can help reduce epithelial ovarian cancer cells in the body. I'm suggesting that you take curcuminoids with green tea. Studies are now showing that the two taken together have a synergistic effect that is more powerful than either separately. And it also was able to induce cellular changes in apoptosis. And apoptosis, A-P-O-P-T-O-S-I-S, that's programmed cell death, meaning the cell is committing suicide, the cancer cell is committing suicide, and that's what you want. Because in that is also the stem cell. So take those two together, let's say 400 milligrams of non-caffeinated green tea and maybe 1,000 milligrams of the curcuminoids. Now, not to be outdone, China Medical University published a study also. And in this study, they're saying that curcumin, cure, C-U-R, cumin, C-U-M-I-N, could reverse the effects of diabetic osteoporosis. And by the way, diabetics are notorious for having thinning of the bones, and hence osteoporosis. So this is one way of strengthening your bones and helping to make sure that you don't end up fracturing. Again, if you're diabetic or pre-diabetic, make sure you're getting your curcumin. I remember once a doctor said he had some interesting therapies that could help using magnets. And I said, well, come into New York, come over to 72nd Street and Broadway, the northeast corner, and there's a steps, go up the steps, second floor, and that's the Tri-State Healing Center. We'd like to look at it, and I'll introduce you. The man was Dr. Philpott. So he brought up these little magnets, and they were stuck into a little board, and you put the board at the base of your head, and you slept there and helped you overcome depression because it rebalanced their serotonin levels, etc. I thought, that's good. If it works, we'd like to see it. So we must have had about 17 medical personnel who spent an afternoon with him while he was demonstrating all this. But at the same time he was there, there was a Dr. Fox from Texas, I believe Dallas. And Dr. Fox had a reputation that was rather unique. There's one area of America, and it's a relatively small area. It's between Denton and Pilot Point, which is about 20 miles. And this is the horse, thoroughbred horse capital of America. And interesting, you'll see little houses, but huge barns. You'll see organic carrots and organic oats and organic apples. Oh, they're very particular about their horses. And these horses are all well-maintained, and they have these beautiful pastures. The pastures are green and rich with clover and alfalfa and bahia and different hays, coastal. These people don't eat well. Their horses do. The horses have a bigger bed to sleep on than the people, but they love their horses. One of the problems is that fractures, because historically, if an animal fractured their leg, they'd be put down, be euthanized. Well, he found a way to go in and wrap the leg. First, they would do surgery, and they would pin the leg. Then they would wrap these magnets around it, but these were electrified magnets, pulsing in magnets. Now, the brilliance of this Dr. Fox, and he was brilliant, was that he figured out, much like Royal Rife did, a frequency that would enhance the fibroblast cells and other cells to come together and heal these. He was so good at, I was told, I had no way of independently verifying it, that in The Black Stallion, there's a scene on the beach where the guy's little boy's laying there on the beach, and suddenly a cobra comes up, it's going to strike him, and the horse comes out of nowhere and kills the cobra. But I was told that there was a mishap, and the horse broke its leg and was going to be put down, and he comes to the rescue and saves the horse's life by having the leg wrapped and healed. They had two other horses as backups. Then he would spend all of his time every day going around and healing fractured horses' legs, that otherwise they'd be put down. Well, he had called about a month before and said he believed it would also work on humans. And so I said, well, come up and show us what you've got and show us the science behind it, and we'll see if we feel there's any merit to it. And he had been showing us all that he had done, and it was extremely complex. He had all these circuitry boards in there hooked up to the magnets. And interesting enough, the same type of magnets that Philpott had. So when I introduced the two of them, it was interesting because there was enormous appreciation of each person towards the other person's work. I would later write a book, and I put 500 peer-reviewed references in it about the science of magnets helping us. Fix magnets you put on your body, magnetic pans. In fact, I even invented some things to help with different parts of the body. In any case, this is today. This is a major university in Canada. Quote, a new type of magnetic stimulation helps reverse concussion symptoms, study finds. Quote, concussion often leads to a number of serious long-term consequences for anyone who suffers one, and as such, early treatment is a must. Now scientists have come up with a novel new idea using magnetic fields to reverse many of the symptoms of concussion. Researchers at the university in Canada have developed a laptop-type device that can apply low-frequency magnetic stimulation to alleviate the symptoms of a concussion. What's more exciting, however, is that the method could potentially protect the brain from future degradation, a risk factor by those who suffered a concussion. And, quote, concussion is a major health concern affecting all sections of society, from children whose brain is still developing to older people suffering falls. So, how about that? And then, quote, using magnetic stimulation on the brain isn't a new concept. Scientists first used it to stimulate nerves and the brain back in 1985. Since then, researchers at Harvard Medical School, McClellan Hospital, have observed promising results in treating mental health conditions with low-frequency magnetic stimulation. Wow. Well, that just happens to be the same year that their Dr. Philpott had already been using magnets for 10 years before that, and Dr. Fox for 5 years before that. So, interesting that people were already doing this, but these people got the credit. Just, I'm always interested in what we were doing then and to help people, and what people are doing now and saying it's revolutionary and brand new. No, It may be revolutionary to what you're doing, but a lot of other people around this world were doing this stuff a long time ago. Here's something from the Journal of Natural Medicines, highly respected journal, and they're looking at research out of South Korea. And they wanted to see about anti-atherosclerotic effects of what is called great millet, or which comes from that is sorghum, S-O-R-G-H-U-M. Now, Americans don't eat sorghum, but people around the world do. It's known to have very strong anti-inflammatory properties. And it's also very powerful antioxidants. And the results of this study showed that by using sorghum, you could help atherosclerosis. Wow, healing atherosclerosis with sorghum? Yeah. Let's put this in proper context, however. Atherosclerosis is a major cause of coronary heart disease, in which atherosclerotic lesions make blood vessels thicker. And this thickening of the blood vessels in turn inhibits blood circulation. And atherosclerosis is caused by a high-fat diet, there's your American diet, and vascular injury, there's your American lifestyle. So chronic arterial inflammation plays an important role in the pathogenesis or the progression of a disease, including atherosclerosis. So secretion of the pro-antherogenic cytokine, tumor necrosis factor A, induces the expression of endothelial adhesion molecules, such as P-section and vascular cell adhesion molecule 1. Well, along comes sorghum, and it helps enhance the healing process, and it is strongly important as an antioxidant. So based upon these results, the researchers concluded that sorghum has great potential as a therapeutic and anti-atherosclerotic agent. And I shared this study with you today because there are thousands upon hundreds of thousands of people who've used sorghum as a part of their overall diet. And of course, you've heard me mention millet many times. Millet is called the poor man's protein. It is easy to prepare. You just put some millet, rinse your millet, of course, and put it in a bowl. And then I just put some hot water in there and just put a little towel over it and come back 10 minutes later and it's done. You'll know it's done when you can eat it without it crunching, but it has kind of an almond flavor to it. Very tasty and very easy to digest. It's probably the easiest of all proteins to digest. So we're not eating enough of it, and we should. And finally, from Isfahan University of Medical Sciences in Iran, comes this study about the decreased serum vitamin D and the greater risk of dry eye disease. And just in lay language, if you're deficient in vitamin D, you're more likely to have dry eyes. So take vitamin D and you can help prevent or overcome dry eyes. Something simple. That's the latest on health and healing. We are 23 minutes into our program. And before we go to a music break, let us hear from Susan. She is one of the participants. I'll hear as you hear what she has to say about what has she learned, keeping this in mind, because I don't know what she's going to say. But normally, with any retreat I do, I start with a series of lectures on the nature of how we think. And I ask the first question I always ask of everyone, what is the central meaning of life? What do you live for? And have you mastered your career before you mastered your own life? That's most professionals, by the way. And if so, what are the consequences? And how can we change that? And why do I do this? It's relatively simple. And by the way, this is the same approach I take with terminally ill people, and I'm counseling them every day, 7 days a week for decades, is I don't just give a protocol. Because a protocol, anybody can do. But the vitamins or the juicing is not going to cure you. It's not going to reverse disease, in my opinion. But learning to have a new mindset, to create a new day, wipe your mind clean. Don't hang on to your pain, your anger, your revenge, whatever it is. Because that's where you stay. So anything you're given is going to be completely subjugated to the dynamic energy of your dark side. And most people, unfortunately and regrettably, live on the dark side, even though most of the people, you would never know it. They smile on the outside and they're in pain on the inside. That's what I call the silent eagle. Whole new concept I'm working on now. I've done 3 lectures on them. And by the way, those lectures are going to be posted this week. One lecture is being posted later today on how to rebalance your life. A very positive look at how we can rebalance our life for what is important and let go into our life what imbalances us. So that will be posted later. And then we have 5 more lectures that will be posted each day this week and up on YouTube. Some of them will not be up on YouTube. They're going directly and exclusively to people who are at home during this study at home. But for everyone else, we've got a lot of material. I did 37 lectures thus far. So all that's going up. In any case, it is my experience and my reality that I can only see people sustain something if they understand who they are at their core values and not what they've become, not what they've mastered, not what they've succeeded at, because that may be a completely different self. Hard to imagine, but when you get into the context of saying you've succeeded, you're successful, are you happy? Do you feel secure? And the answer is, when I'm sitting one-on-one, the answer is no. Well, then shouldn't we get you off the road instead of keep picking you up? And the trouble with Oprah and all these other people who I do not respect at all, for a lot of reasons I won't get into it now, but this is not the first time you've heard me say this, is that these people give people, in my opinion, a false sense of hope that if you just buy this book or buy this product or listen to me every day, you know, don't look at what I am, you know, don't look at what choices I make, but I'm giving you the best experts. Well, fine. But then you're asking a person to get up from your depression, get up from your disease, get up from your infirmaries, get up from your loneliness, whatever is holding you down, get up and continue on your road. And I say exactly the opposite. That's absolutely the worst advice you could give someone, in my opinion, because you're assuming that they're on the right road. And I've had a lifetime of clinical experience showing most people who are out of balance because they did everything everyone else expected them to do. They did it diligently. They worked hard at it. They succeeded at it. And there's the big empty. So why don't you give a person for the first time in their life a chance to choose the road they want on, choose the people they want in their life, choose to what they can do with their heart energy, their brain energy, their creative energy, without you meddling, without you sticking your nose in their business, micromanaging. And whole cultures do this, not just one family member. The whole damn culture is an extension of a person's belief. So where is the person in that culture? Well, they don't exist. The culture does. The paradigm exists. The individual is of no relevance. Well, in my world, the person is all that's relevant, and the culture is secondary. So why don't you just start by asking yourself the hard questions? Are you on the right road and getting up and going forward? Will you do anything more than what you've done 100 times before? Well, I'll weather this crisis, I'll weather this storm, things will get better. Things are not going to get better. Not at this time. You're delusional if you think they are. But what can happen is you can at least see the world for what it is, you're who you are, by being honest and starting a journey over, and this time where you're the architect, you own the energy and no one else. Even with the best of intents, mother, father, brother, teachers, everyone else could have given you their opinion, their biases, and you absorb it like a sponge, then you are them. The collective energy become the dominant energy, and the dominant energy suppresses and collapses all other idealistic energies, including the real you that wanted to emerge, and now you're submerged. Anyhow, you'll see this in these videos in depth. Now let's hear what Susan has to say about her experience up to this point.
This is Susan, and I'm 77 years old, and I'm about to retire from teaching. I came to Gary's anti-aging retreat because I really want to make a sea change in my life. And being healthy and cognitively sharp is certainly what would allow me to accomplish my goals. I'm a practicing artist. There are lots of things that I still want to do with my art and in my life, and I need to get past some serious problems that plague me, such as painting block on and off. And I very much want to walk the walk more than talk the talk, and get more involved in social and issues having to do with helping people beyond whatever my art is doing. When I take a hard look at why I haven't, I see deep-seated, often paralyzing self-doubt and fear that accompanies my excuses to myself about why I'm not able to do this or that. I don't have enough time, my health would be impacted, I wouldn't be perceived as intelligent. For years, I have known that I have to change my inner life in order to change my external life. And I have tried to do this, but with only marginal success, but never getting to the root of it. Now, since I've been here, it's clear I need to radically restructure my belief system, to let go of that underlying stalking, that hidden negativity that's invisible to others, that Gary calls the silent ego, that comprises and erodes my attempts to move forward. There are the sad stories of my life and the remaining destructive behaviors and thinking that have held me back. Gary has been giving us tools and understanding to help us bring into the daylight our authentic selves and to reveal the meaning of who we are, to help us to identify and feel our passion. Apart from the vegan food and the juicing and exercise, we're in silence, which allows the meditation, the communing with nature, and the journaling to take hold and create a breeding ground for self-revelation. This is reinforced by nightly lectures during the week. There's some issues that I've written down that were important to me. To decide what you need to master on your new journey, seek tools that won't limit you, do everything with honesty, ethically, and with humanity. There are no shortcuts in life. Stay on track until the task is done. Discipline is paramount. You must go through discomfort to grow and change. Don't personalize information. Stay grounded in humility. You can't chatter and have consciousness. You must go deep into the dark side of your life in order to change it to light. Anything learned or achieved is only for now, today. Stasis will erode it. You must keep it alive through growth. Think to foresee and avoid unintended consequences. Have the courage to act when action is needed for the good of others and yourself. You can't change your health or your life if you don't change your belief system. I've been very lucky to have this opportunity. Thanks.
Okay, Susan is making some major breakthroughs. In fact, many of the people are making major breakthroughs. So let's just put it this way. You go into an average nutritionist's office, doctor's office, dentist's office, whoever may be qualified to help you. And they start off with the idea of looking at the symptom, what hurts. And that's where their emphasis goes. I do just the opposite. I'm not looking at the symptom. I look at the underlying cause. And if you can't change the underlying cause, no matter what protocol you're given, you're just going to keep repeating it. And that's what I've seen. So the people who are most likely to get healthy, reverse their aging, prevent disease, reverse the disease they have, including all these comorbidities that are the real killers out there. It's in the presence of a coronavirus that they tip into the death cycle. But all of the causes are coronavirus, meaning that's one of the things I'm going to talk about tomorrow, that instead of attributing, here's how many people died, here's what they actually died from by autopsy. And the coronavirus was present, but was only a mitigating factor. Well, that's why that the people who are dying are the sickest people already in a society. They're dying in any case. So shouldn't we be honest about the actual cause of death? Because think of all the senior citizens who have not died, but have been infected. Why aren't we measuring those individuals against those same age who are already comorbid, meaning they have diabetes, emphysema, they might have been smokers, like a lot of the Spanish and Italians were, and they'd reached their normal lifespan in any case. And then why not take a look at a group of people the same age but who were health-minded? We haven't done that. So we're not doing good science right now. I'm not saying it's intentional. I have no conspiratorial framework when it comes to that. I haven't seen it yet. But I'm just saying it's just bad science. So what I believe where the journey should start, from my opinion, and where I've been able to help the most people recover their health and extend their life or reverse disease, is where they're happy enough, content enough, in balance enough to make right choices going forward. And that can help undo a lot of the damage done and prevent further damage in the future. Otherwise, you can end up like the gentleman who comes into my office, a very well-known, everyone in this audience would know this person's name and work. And I give him 3 hours of my time. He says he's going to do it immediately, thanks me, goes downstairs. I go down to get in a cab to go to the airport, and corner in a hamburger joint, eating hamburgers, smoking a cigarette, drinking a cola, and having french fries. That's what happens when you don't work on the dark side of your being first. You may want to be healthy and happy, but the older you are, the more difficult it's going to be to change. You resist change even when it's in your best interest. And hence, that's what the concept of the silent ego, and I'll go into the great depth on that coming up. I've done 5 hours of lectures on it, so you'll have a chance. It's as important as the life energy lectures I did about 25 years ago. Anyhow, now I would like for you to hear something I think is really important. This is from a board-certified physician and author of published articles, a scientist and clinician, Dr. Paul Marik, M-A-R-I-K, and he's lecturing before a group of physicians, and he is an ICU, intensive care unit physician. And we're only going to play about 15 minutes of this, but it's all about one nutrient that is not used and should be for every single person who's in ICU right now. If we gave every single person intravenous vitamin C, we could probably be saving 70 or 80% of their lives. But the medical paradigm will not allow this. And he's even skeptical that the people in his audience will believe him. Now we go to his story.
About a special pharmacological intervention. And obviously Mervyn was really skeptical. Well, he wasn't really alone, because my colleagues, when I told them what was going on, thought it was the biggest lot of nonsense they had ever seen. But then they actually saw that none of our patients were dying, and then our CEO saw that none of the patients were dying. So this has become actually instituted throughout our whole healthcare system. And we were going to do an RCT, but we couldn't because it would have been unethical. So that's just the starting point, and I really hear, but it is what it is. So it's a story. So I think, like most stories, it's worthwhile telling some other stories. Always a story within a story. So we need to talk about Ignaz Semmelweis. He was an obstetric resident in Vienna in the 1800s. And what was quite interesting at that time is that in Vienna, lying in hospital, there were two wards. The ward, which is illustrated in green, was run by midwives. The ward in red was run by obstetricians and academic physicians. And the risk of dying, as you can see from puerperal sepsis, was significantly higher in the first lying-in ward than the second lying-in ward. And they had this randomization scheme, which John would like. It was like every other day you were randomized to one other unit. And he was intrigued by this difference. He couldn't understand it. And then he made the observation that what happened in the morning is the obstetricians would go, they would do autopsies, and then they would go from the autopsy room and do vaginal examination deliveries without ever washing their hands. So he surmised that they were transmitting something. So he instituted hand washing with chlorated lime. And he noted this dramatic reduction in mortality. So he presented this data, and he was ridiculed. He was laughed at. He was mocked. How could it be possible that washing your hands could prevent these women dying of puerperal sepsis? It just didn't fit with the pathophysiology of the day. He was ridiculed, and in fact, he was kicked out of his program, and he lost his job. It even went worse. He tried to present this at medical meetings and was booed and was hissed, and was in fact declared mentally insane. He was admitted to a mental asylum involuntarily and actually died 2 weeks later trying to escape. So my story is almost identical. We have a before and after. So my advantage is that I outlived Ignaz Semmelweis. He died at 47. Secondly, as Rob knows, I'm already being declared mentally ill, so, and receiving therapy, so that's not going to work. But my advantage over Ignac is I have an enormous base of solid scientific data to support me, whereas unfortunately he didn't have that, because people didn't know about bugs like Mervyn was talking about. He talked about cadaveric particles. So my story is exactly the same, and presumably most of you are going to be as skeptical as the audience was when Ignac presented his data, but that's fine, because you know what, we'll see the truth. So sepsis is a global problem, about 20 million cases per year. The mortality in resource-poor countries is about 60%. So this is a really important disease, and a lot of people die. We know that all the pillars of surviving sepsis have come crashing down. There's not a single element in surviving sepsis that actually has any scientific basis at all. We also know that there have been over 100 phase 2 and phase 3 clinical trials for sepsis. And we know that we had activated protein C for a transitory time, but basically there hasn't been a single molecule or intervention which has been shown, until today, to change the natural history of sepsis. This is from Professor Edward Abraham. Sepsis is a common, life-threatening, and increasingly frequent medical problem that consumes huge amounts of resources. Mortality remains high. The long-term effects, including total disability, severe. We desperately need new diagnostic and therapeutic approaches to sepsis. Hopefully, I will share some of those with you today. So I'm going to talk about our magic bullet. John doesn't believe in magic bullets, but you make your own conclusion for sepsis. So this is drug A and drug B, and it wasn't that we decided one day we were going to find the cure for sepsis. Like most things, the apple falling out of the tree, it just happened. It was a fortuitous set of circumstances that led to us doing what we did. So we give drug A and drug B, it's very mysterious, they're both anti-inflammatory, increase pressure sensitivity, preserve endothelial integrity, ready available, cheap and safe. Both drugs have been available since 1949. Interesting, both were released in 1949, tested for the same disease. So we have hundreds of scientific articles going back to 1949. So this is not something new that I've invented. It's been there. It just took us to, we think, put the pieces together. Drug A and drug B. So now I'll take you out of your misery. Corticosteroids and vitamin C. What? You've got to be kidding. Okay, so what I will do is I will show you our data, but more importantly, I'll show you the underlying scientific data and rationale of why this is just so cool. It's really cool. So I wrote a little editorial, vitamin C and vitamin C for the treatment of severe sepsis and septic shock. This is our little recipe. Vitamin C, hydrocortisone 50 Q6 for 6 days, and then taper. We've kind of changed that a bit. Vitamin C, 1.5 grams Q8 for 4 days, and for good measure, we threw in thiamine, but you'll see the rationale for the thiamine. So this is our study. It's a before-after study. We collected enough data to make it semi-robust so I could present at this meeting, and also we felt that we had an ethical imperative to spread this data, because I think this saves lives, and I think that there may be skeptics in the room, but as I'll show you, it is completely safe. You have nothing to lose except a surviving patient. So this is our study. It's published in Chest as an EPUB. It's available now. I'm not going to go through all the data. I think what's much more important is the scientific underpinning of the study, which is profoundly strong. So basically, this started just by accident on the 5th of January, 2016. We had a patient dying of overwhelming sepsis. This lady was 48 years old. She had E. coli and Clostridia perfringens in the blood. She was going to die in front of my eyes. And we thought, you know what? Let's try something. And this was the something we did. The next day, she was extubated off presses. And we said, shit, what just happened? So that's really how it started. So we collected patients over 7 months. We used the same inclusion and exclusion criteria. We used procalcitonin level than greater than 2. We didn't really know what we were doing then, but you'll see how important the procalcitonin is. We had a control group treated exactly the same. So I outlined to you our protocol, and that we've been doing for 2 or 3 years, so nothing changed. Nothing changed between this time except the period of the sun and the moon. The only exclusion criteria were if you're less than 18, if you were pregnant, or if patients had a limitation of care on admission to the hospital. As I said, this is our management strategy, which we kind of went through. Our outcome measures were hospital survival. That's kind of an important outcome that most patients would really be interested in, as well as some other things which provide really physiological, really remarkable justification for what happened. So the patient characteristics I'll go through quickly, really typical of patients in the US, about 60 years old, half were getting presses, lactate about 3, had a really high procalcitonin. So we measured vitamin C, not in all patients because it requires special testing. So I point this out because it's quite important. The normal blood levels, as we'll see, is 40 to 60 micromoles. You can see the average level was 14. These patients, there were some patients who had undetectable vitamin C in the blood. As I will tell you, critical illness is an ascorbutic disease. It does not differ from scurvy. These patients have acute scurvy. If you're critically ill, your vitamin C levels are profoundly reduced, if not undetectable. And you can see the levels were really low. The patients, however, had severe comorbidities.
Now, I want you to have an opportunity to call in, and Jesse will see what you have to say and put you up on the air at 888-874-4888. But here is our question, and I think it's appropriate. He is suggesting, Linus Pauling suggested, Albert St. George suggested, hundreds of people I've known in science with impeccable backgrounds. In fact, St. George and Linus Pauling had three Nobel Prizes between them. These were not foolish people. They said that we're not recognizing subclinical scurvy. And this doctor is just suggesting that a lot of patients, those who are dying of sepsis or septicemia, they have a form of scurvy. We're not recognizing it. So if we start encouraging people to take more vitamin C, whatever type they want, and either direct by mouth throughout the day, or in a protein shake, which allows them to take probably 3 times more because it's buffered by the protein in the shake, or by intravenous, which is the most powerful and medicinally beneficial, I believe that we could see diabetes, cancers, emphysema, COPD, and even the regular flu and colds substantially mitigated. That's his experience. Now, he goes on for another 25 minutes discussing this in depth and giving example after example. Remember about 6 months ago, I played a clip from 60 Minutes Australia, which does very good work, by the way. And they had an example of a man who was he's going to be taking off his respirator, and he would have died within minutes because there was nothing more they could do. His lungs were completely filled, and they tried intravenous vitamin C, and it worked. And he was able to be saved. They didn't believe it. They were against it until they saw it actually worked. This saved his life. And no no thanks to the physicians and nurses, it had everything to do with family members. And there's Dr. Kallikakorias, who I met 40 years ago from Australia, and he was at that time one of the two leading physicians in the world. There was a Dr. Klinner and him. No one else was using vitamin C at high doses. They were. And evidently he had some impact on people at that time. This is just a regular farmer. He would have been dead. Vitamin C saved his life, and 60 Minutes did a piece on it. Would you think that maybe then there would be some studies? Some university hospitals would start to include vitamin C in people in their regimens? No, never happened. That's how powerful the big pharma is. That's how powerful big pharma's lobbyists are. That's how powerful they are at constricting important original medical research. Now, right now, I believe that one of the tools, I don't criticize the other tools they're using, but one tool they could be using then or not, and the Chinese have already used it, there are two separate studies, intravenous vitamin C at 24,000 milligrams. I never gave 24,000 milligrams. That's not even a starting point for me. All of our patients, thousands and thousands of patients are alive today because we started very high doses and monitored them. They came in, had all their blood workups done, and you'll see the viral loads go down, you'll see their deficiencies overcome, you'll see their disease mitigated. But at least if China did this in two hospitals and no one died from coronavirus, that should be a big sign that says, do more research, let's try it. Here's my question to you then. Why is American medicine so absolutely resistant to anything that is natural, non-toxic? Why? Why are physicians refusing to do some innovative work unless it's under the rubric of acceptable medical practice or current scientific standards medical practice by the AMA? The organization was found guilty, by the way, along with the 12 largest medical organizations in America, of restraint of trade and violation of the Sherman Antitrust Act. I was a part of that action because it was my articles way back in Caveat Emptor and then later in other publications that showed the dirty tricks they were doing. So I have no respect for the AMA. I've seen its long and sordid history. But it has the power. Pharmaceutical companies with their hundreds of thousands of resolved lawsuits because of their lying and deceptive ways, they still have the power. They're sanitized. There's nothing they can do. There's no crime against humanity they can commit and without walking away from it. Why? Why aren't we awakening to how utterly corrupt the entirety of our medical industrial complex is? That doesn't mean every doctor or nurse is corrupt. That means the system is corrupt. Those who compromise to their own economic ends and proprietary medicine are corrupt. That's the high cost of billing is corrupt. Now I'm going to deal with that tomorrow. Your thoughts, please. 888-874-4888. I'd like to hear what you have to say. All right? And while you're thinking about calling in and sharing some insights, I'll share just a few other things today that I think are important. This is an article by Tim Gerhardy in the National Review, and it says, quote, "The trail leading back to the Wuhan labs. There's no proof the coronavirus accidentally escaped from a laboratory. But we can't take the Chinese government's denials at face value. It is understandable that many would be wary of the notion that the origin of the coronavirus could be discovered by some documentary filmmaker who used to live in China, Matthew Tai, who creates YouTube videos, contends he has identified the source of the coronavirus, and a great deal of information that he presents obtained from public records posted on the internet checks out. The Wuhan Institute of Virology in China indeed posted a job opening on November 18th, 2019, quote, asking for scientists to come research the relationship between the coronavirus and bats, end quote. The Google translation of the job posting is, quote, taking bats as the research object, I will answer the molecular mechanisms that can coexist with Ebola and SARS-associated coronavirus for a long time without disease and its relationship with flight and longevity. Virology, immunology, cell biology, and multiple omics are used to compare the differences between humans and other mammals," end quote. All right, On December 24, 2019, the Wuhan Institute for Virology posted a second job posting. The translation of that posting includes the declaration, quote, long-term research on the pathogenic biology of bats carrying important viruses has confirmed the origin of bats of major human, new human and livestock infections, diseases such as SARS and SADS, and a large number of new bat and rodent new viruses have been discovered and identified. Tai contends that the posting meant, quote, we've discovered a new and terrible virus and would like to recruit people to come and deal with it, end quote. He also contends that, quote, news didn't come out about coronavirus until ages after that, end quote. Doctors Nguyen knew that they were dealing with a cluster of pneumonia cases as December progressed, but it is accurate to say that a very limited number of people knew about this particular strain of coronavirus and its severity at the time of that job posting. By December 31st, about 3 weeks after the doctors first noticed the case, the Chinese government notified the World Health Organization, and the first media reports about, quote, the mysterious pneumonia appeared outside China. Scientific America verifies much of the information. Tai mentions about Shi Xingli and the Chinese virologist nicknamed Batwoman for her work with that species. And then it goes on to this. What this is simply suggesting is that we still to this day do not know the full truth. So how can we go forward if we don't know what the progenitor was, what the beginning of this was? And the World Health Organization is very much controlled by China. Bill from Long Island, your turn.
Yes. Hi, Gary. How you doing?
Good.
Good. Long time listener. But there's something that you say that's been puzzling me for a while. You know, you talk about, rightfully so, the lunatics that are in the medical system, the CEOs and all of these profiteers that are taking advantage of people. And it's thoroughly corrupt, the whole system. And then you say, but let's have Medicare for all or a universal system. And who do you think is going to be in charge of that system?
Okay, you've made a completely valid point, Bill, but here's the answer. In a Medicare for all, at least people would not go bankrupt because of medical bills. Set aside whether it's a private care system where they were and are going bankrupt. Just one of the people here showed me a bill for $10,000 at New York University's Lagoon Center where he went for a stomach ache. They gave him an ice pack. And no surgery, no medical intervention, and they charged him $10,000 and he had to pay it. I don't want to see anyone else go bankrupt, and I don't want to see anyone who could be treated, and there are drugs and treatments within orthodox medicine that do work. You have to differentiate a system by what doesn't work and should be changed. Individuals who are greedy but competent, so they're trying to make as much money as they can off of you, but maybe the treatment they're giving is viable. If you're in a car wreck, you're not asking how much is this going to cost me to stop my internal bleeding and save my life. So you can't conflate all of these issues into one. As I also said, there are a lot of honest doctors and nurses within the hospital system, and there are ethicists within the medical system. It's that their voices are not the dominant ones. It's not an all or nothing. So I'd rather see it start by seeing that everybody is treated and then add into that equation that you also have a preventative program starting in high school or junior high or grade school as a regular public service. The Surgeon General actually does something for once. I've not seen any of them do anything in decades where you prevent diseases without any outside interference by special interest groups, which would otherwise happen. And we have enough citizen journalists and enough consumer advocates to know whether or not the information we'd be received is just propaganda. Eat your cornflakes, you know, have a hamburger. That's propaganda. Eat a plant-based diet. That's the science supporting that. So it'd be science-based. And there'd be safeguards. And then incorporate those peer-reviewed studies that support complementary alternative medical practices. This is a process. It takes time for this process to work because you've got to, in effect, show that a new paradigm could supersede the old paradigm. It's just like positive thinking has to supersede negative thinking, or negative thinking dominates. So don't look at it fatalistically. Look at it as the first step in allowing healthcare to be more based upon real science and less on proprietary science. I appreciate your input. Thank you very much. We're out of time, everyone. Thank you all for listening, and have a nice day.